From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration is facing a broad class action lawsuit over its detention of immigrant children. The Southern Poverty Law Center filed the suit in January to address the fact that about 10,000 undocumented children are being held in detention, and it appears that the federal government is delaying their release in order to lure in sponsors to come forward. If sponsors are found to be undocumented themselves, they're often arrested and entered into deportation proceedings. In its complaint, SPLC said, quote, as revealed by a recently leaked memorandum, the Trump administration decided to deter illegal immigration by enacting a policy to use detained immigrant children as bait to arrest immigrants who come forward to sponsor them, even while explicitly acknowledging that this would prolong the detention of immigrant children. To do this, they twisted the sponsorship process from its congressionally mandated purpose of ensuring children's safety while placing them in the least restrictive setting as quickly as possible, introducing steps counterproductive to that goal that were instead designed to facilitate civil immigration enforcement against sponsors. Joining me to explain more about the lawsuit is Syra Draper. She's a senior staff attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome to the program, Syra.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as I understand it, sponsorship, in the quote that I mentioned, is something that was enacted by Congress in order to ensure a child's safety. A child is always best looked after when they're in the custody of either a parent or an older relative, et cetera, right? That's the whole goal, right?
That's exactly right. Even the government has said that the government makes lousy parents. So the goal of the regulations that we have in place now are to get children with people who can take care of them, people who love them, their parents, close family members, somebody like that can look after them.
So it used to be that people or a child who came in unaccompanied, as they call it, unaccompanied minors, if they were in government custody, the government would try to find their sponsors and then release the child into the sponsor's custody. What has been happening under the Trump administration that this lawsuit is based on?
Yeah, so under the Trump administration, the process of getting the child to the sponsor has been delayed. So in the past, you know, these children come in and a lot of times they have a little piece of paper in their pocket with the phone number of their mother, their grandmother, their uncle, whoever that they know is here in the United States. That person may know that they're coming or may not know that they're coming. But as soon as that child gets into the United States and is picked up, they can give that number to the government and a call will go out and that person will have the option to sponsor that child and get them out of government custody. The government has to go through so the goal of the government is to get the child into the hands of that person that wants to take care of them as soon as possible, but also to do so within the best interests of the child. So sometimes there is some vetting that takes place to make sure that the person is who they say they are and they can, in fact, take care of the child. But under the Trump administration's new policy, that vetting process has been rife with hurdles, opaqueness. There's arbitrary nature to it. The person who is a child's case manager has unfettered discretion about whether to place that child with the potential sponsor. And the whole process has just become very bleak and burdensome on sponsors. And in the meantime, the child sits in detention.
So what's happening to sponsors now? We had been hearing on a case-by-case basis anecdotal evidence that sponsors who were coming forward to claim the children were themselves being arrested and deported or being entered into deportation proceedings. How widespread, as far as you know, is this practice by the government?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I believe it was in April of 2018 that the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is tasked with placing these children, entered into a memorandum of understanding, a memorandum of agreement with ICE to share some of the fingerprinting information and biometric information they have had obtained on sponsors with ICE. So we know that within the first 4 months of the implementation of that policy, 170 would-be sponsors were arrested. And the memorandum of understanding is still relatively new, so we have yet to see the final impact that has caused. But I can speak to some of the children that we have spoken to. There's one child in particular who his father wanted to sponsor him. And within 3 days of submitting his fingerprint information to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, ICE was one block from his house. The father left his house to go to work one day. ICE arrested him, and he was shortly thereafter deported. So it is absolutely happening. We're hearing about it from these children, and it continues to happen to this day.
So the parent is deported. The child remains in U.S. custody?
That's absolutely right. So it's clearly not in the best interest of the child to have their would-be sponsor deported. In some circumstances, the child may have somebody else that is able to sponsor them, but that's not always the case. And even if that child has somebody else that otherwise would have been willing to sponsor them, they become scared and don't want to sponsor the child after, as in this case, the father had been deported. They no longer are willing to sponsor the child out of fear of what might happen to them. So it has a very chilling effect on the entire process. And in the meantime, the child languishes in detention.
So let's talk about some of these cases. The children, the lead plaintiffs in this class action lawsuit, are minors who in the complaint are referred to just by their initials. I understand that you've met several of them and had a chance to speak with them. There's one case, CECP, are the initials of this particular person. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so CECP was an interesting case that came to us. This is a child who came from Honduras, I believe, and his sponsor is actually a U.S. citizen, his cousin, who is a U.S. citizen here, born and raised in Connecticut. And his sponsor did everything that the case manager told her to do. There was a home study of the house. She had her fingerprints done and submitted. She provided a family reunification packet with lots of information about her and her husband and her minor son. And then it seemed like there was always another step that came up. Toward the end, the case manager told CECP's sponsor that they didn't believe that CECP was actually 17 years old. They believed that his birth certificate had been doctored in some way, and asked the sponsor to get another copy of the child's birth certificate. So the sponsor in that case really believed that the government was just trying to prolong CECP's detention until he became 18 years old, because once a child becomes 18 years old, they are transferred from ORR custody to ICE custody. So it was one of these situations where it was very opaque, very arbitrary, and it seemed like the goalpost was always moving on the sponsor. Even though the sponsor was doing exactly as she was told, it was never sufficient. There was always something else that she had to do. Now, luckily, after we became involved and we included them in this lawsuit, CECP was released. I believe he was released on this past Sunday.
Wow. So it sounded in this specific case, where the sponsor was a U.S. citizen, that the government was trying to entrap the child themselves, a 17-year-old on the cusp of being legally treated as an adult, and the government sounded like it was sort of waiting it out till he could be seen as an adult in the eyes of the federal government.
That's absolutely what the sponsor believed.
Wow. What about, so there's another case here of a person whose initials are YRRB, and another person that you've met as well?
A young man, I believe he's 16 years old, also from Honduras. The sad thing about his case is that he left Honduras because of the gang violence there. Some of the gangs tried to have them work for them, and he fled because of that. When he was in a detention, he has been in several detention centers here in the United States, but in one of the detention centers he was in, he got in a fight. He got in a, you know, scuffle with another boy. Neither of them was seriously hurt, but that evening, YRRB went to bed thinking everything was normal. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, he was woken up, ripped out of bed, wasn't told anything about where he was going or why. He was put on a plane and sent to a medium security facility where he is now, outside Tacoma, Washington. When he arrived in Tacoma, somebody finally told him that he was suspected of being in a gang, and that's why he had been transferred. You know, this is the arbitrariness. You know, whether you get transferred, why you get transferred, that happens to children all the time. They don't have any say. They can't ask, you know, what evidence do you have that I was in a gang? I think this case was particularly egregious because YRRB left Honduras to be away from the gangs, and now, you know, instead he's being associated with the gangs by proximity because he had, you know, fled them. He's being assumed to have been in the gang. And when a child is transferred to a different facility, obviously it has a profound impact on them emotionally. Any kind of security that they had in their schedule or their friends that they might have had at the different facility is gone. Any kind of stability that they had is gone. And it also speaks to, you know, the unpredictability of the process. But beyond that, what normally happens is that the sponsorship application process starts all over again. So in this case, YRRB's sister was his is his potential sponsor.
So if he gets transferred to another facility, they have to start all over again. So the government, that's another way the government can keep prolonging the detention of these kids, just keep transferring them.
That's right. And as I said, they can't appeal a transfer. There isn't any evidence that's brought forward to say this is why you should be transferred. It literally happened at three in the morning. He was ripped out of his bed. And his sister, his would-be sponsor, has now had to provide the same materials over and over again to attempt to get him released.
Wow. There is a child who goes by the initial CMM in this case as well. Can you tell us about CMM, who is also another person that you met?
CMM, it's, I think, a problem that a lot of the children who don't speak Spanish as a first language, is emblematic of a lot of the struggles that they deal with. So CMM is from Guatemala. Spanish is not his first language. In fact, he didn't start learning Spanish until he came to the United States.
So he spoke an indigenous language?
Exactly. He speaks Jakaltek. So he did not speak any English until he got here. Now he speaks some limited Spanish. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I said English, I meant Spanish. He didn't speak any Spanish until he got here. He speaks some limited Spanish now. But one of the first facilities he was in was Casa Padre in Brownsville, Texas. It is literally a converted Walmart warehouse that they have made into a shelter for children. He was able to find a few other kids that spoke his language, but he was really limited to communicating with them, and he had a lot of difficulty communicating with any of the staff at the facility. I think, you know, that kind of environment where you cannot communicate really leads children who are frustrated and don't know what's going on, they can act out, they can become upset. In his case, he also had a scuffle with another child, was transferred to a more secure facility, and because he continues to be upset, be depressed, and act out, he is subjected to more and more restrictions. So in his case, he is not permitted to speak on the phone without being monitored. So he has maybe 10 minutes every other day that he's allowed to speak to his mother, but somebody has to be monitoring their conversation. And he has been told now that he cannot speak to his mother in his native language. He must speak in Spanish. So you can imagine how frustrating that must be. You know, he has 10 minutes every couple of days to speak to the one person that he wants to speak to, who he knows cares for him, and he can't even fully communicate with her because he's being told what language he can speak in.
And why do you think that is? Why do they want him to speak in Spanish? Is it because they're basically surveilling these kids and, you know, eavesdropping on their phone calls with their sponsors?
Absolutely. And I've had several situations where I call to speak to children. Even for me as an attorney, it was extremely hard to get access to these children. There are circumstances where I have called and I have to ask the child several times, you know, it's a privileged communication between attorney and client. I have to ask them, are you alone in a room? Are you alone in a room? And unless I, you know, am very direct with the staff people about allowing the child to be alone in a room to talk to me, sometimes even those conversations are surveilled.
So you and I have been mostly talking about teenage boys, young immigrants from Central America. I understand that there are also girls among the plaintiffs, one of whom you've met. Can you tell us her story?
Absolutely. So ACMS is a young woman from Honduras, and her story is particularly heartbreaking. She left Honduras because she was the victim of sexual abuse. She's very traumatized by that abuse, and she came here to be with her father, who lives in New Jersey. She has been in detention for going on 5 months now. And in the facility where she is being kept, she is receiving some counseling for the trauma that she has suffered. But because she has been in this detention facility for as long as she has, she was subjected, she was re-traumatized. So in the facility where she is, there is a no-touch policy. The women, the girls cannot touch each other, and the staff cannot touch the women. When I met ACMS, she told me about a gentleman, a man who worked on the staff, who worked the night shift. And that man, on several occasions, would touch ACMS. So he would touch, caress her on the arm. And ACMS started speaking with some of the other girls, and the other girls had the same concerns. Apparently, the staff person had walked into the bedroom of one of the girls, where he's not allowed to be, had sat on the end, on the foot of the bed, and started caressing this other young woman's feet and telling her to wake up. So that is a violation of the shelter's policy. And ACMS told me point blank, she says, you know, I am the victim of sexual abuse. I knew exactly what he was doing. He was taking advantage of the situation. He was trying to exert control over me. And she was understandably very concerned about where that was going. So in a sense, because she was there, you know, she was being re-victimized all over again. It doesn't matter how many sessions with the therapist you have while you're in these centers. If you're subjected to these kinds of circumstances, you're going to come out of there worse for the wear. These young women in the shelter actually brought up the situation with management at the facility, and the management at the facility asked them what they thought they should do about the situation. And the girls asked management to tell that man never to come back. And management told them that they would investigate, but they didn't make any assurances about whether that staff person would come or come back. So, you know, ACMS told me that she was having nightmares. She actually asked for a roommate, and her roommate would stay in their room with the lights on and the door open, petrified that this man was going to come back in the middle of the night and hurt them and retaliate against them.
It's pretty terrifying to hear about these stories, and I'm wondering if you can wrap up by giving us one last story of what happens when you have siblings that are detained together. So EAX is another child whose initials are EAX, was, I understand, a child that was detained along with siblings, but whose parents are in the United States and could have been sponsors. This story seems to be a very quintessential example of what the government is trying to do to use children as bait. Tell us the story.
Right. So EAX came from Guatemala along with his two younger brothers. Initially, they were all in a detention center together. But EAX had an incident. I don't remember the details of the incident now, but it was relatively minor. But because of that incident, he was transferred and his two brothers remained in the facility. Now, their father, who lived in Nebraska at the time, said that he would be the sponsor for the three boys. So he got started on the sponsorship process for the three boys. Shortly after EAX was separated from his brothers, the father, as part of the reunification process, went to give his fingerprints to ORR. I think we mentioned before that ORR has a sharing policy. They now share certain information with ICE. So ORR shared this information, the fingerprinting information about the father, with ICE. And ICE decided, 3 days after that information was shared, ICE found the father, and he was a few days later deported to Guatemala.
Wow.
So these three boys were left without a sponsor. The father's wife decided to step in and continue the sponsorship process for these boys. And EAX's two brothers were eventually released to the mother, but EAX, because he was in a different facility, was not released. But I would like to mention a little bit about his mental health deterioration after that point, because after EAX had been separated from his brothers, and after he found out that his father had been deported because he had attempted to sponsor the boys, it severely impacted his mental health. He really his condition deteriorated. He became very depressed, to the point that he was being prescribed medications to help him with his depression, and eventually he did have there was a another incident after he found out that his stepmother was no longer able to sponsor him, and at that point he attempted a suicide, and he had to be hospitalized for several days. And I think the worst part of the story is, instead of sending him to a facility that could care for his mental health issues, he was then transferred to one of the country's most secure, highest security detention facilities out near Sacramento, California. So that's where he remains to this day. His father is in Guatemala. He's been deported. His stepmother no longer feels like she can sponsor him. So he is left now in this very restrictive setting, obviously with these mental health issues still there, and no one to sponsor him.
Wow, unbelievable. And so what do you hope the lawsuit does? So it's a class action lawsuit, so everybody who's considered part of the class, it could, you know, it's basically children in these conditions, and you've just filed the lawsuit. Unfortunately, of course, these things never go fast enough. What are your hopes for this lawsuit, given that there are so many lives and so many kids' well-being at stake?
I mean, obviously, we hope that we get the relief that we're asking for under the lawsuit. We're hoping that the policies that the government has in place now become more transparent, that there is a that the arbitrariness of the process is resolved, and that the time that children stay in detention is not what it is now, that it can be streamlined. That's number one. But I think the second issue, that the second goal that we have with this lawsuit, is to bring this to the attention of the American people. I mean, I think as a society, we value family reunification. We think it's important that children should be with their parents. We understand that these children are escaping terrible conditions, and what they don't need is to escape that trauma and then be re-traumatized here on our ground. I hope that we can bring this to the attention of the American people, because I do believe that if the public knows about this, they will not stand for it.
Well, Saira, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website that you can give out for more information about the lawsuit?
Well, our lawsuit is posted on SPLC's website, and I believe that's www.splcenter.org.
That's right, splcenter.org. We'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much, Saira. Good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much.
My guest has been Saira Draper, Senior Staff Attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center. We've been discussing SPLC's lawsuit against the government over using immigrant children as bait. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.